The Douglas Coleman Show is made possible with support from Seth David Radwell, a recent guest on the program and author of American Schism, How the Two Enlightenments Hold the Secret to Healing Our Nation, released this past July. As Publishers Weekly writes in its recent glowing book life review of American Schism, business executive Radwell's epic debut examines the historical influences that have led to what he sees as the collapse of politics in the United States. Seth Radwell makes the case that the current chasm between the American right and left can be traced back to the 18th century's Age of Enlightenment and the basic tenets of liberty, equality, and reason. American Schism provides a historical perspective that can help us fight today's unreason with reason and bridge current day divides. American Schism by Seth David Radwell is available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and wherever books are sold. For more information, go to AmericanSchismBook.com.
It's time for the Douglas Coleman Show. Mr. Smooth and Savvy is joined by guests from all walks of life, from the entertainment industry to authors to political and social commentators, the famous and not so famous, the controversial and the light and fluffy. We have it all. Now, here's Douglas Coleman.
Okay, please welcome back to the Douglas Coleman Show, Seth David Radwell. Hey, Seth, how are you? Welcome back.
Hi, Douglas. Thank you for having me back. It's a pleasure to be here, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. Did you do anything exciting on New Year's, or did you stay home, or what?
We were in Sedona, Arizona, which was beautiful, but the weather was not great, and then we were in L.A. for a little bit. You know, it's been such a crazy holiday season again with Omicron, and it seems like we can't seem to get out of our own way with COVID. So that was a damper a bit.
Well, you know, just speaking of COVID very quickly, I'm hoping that this is sort of the last hurrah of this thing, because it seems to be so contagious that if everybody gets it, and if everybody or most people are vaccinated, they're going to experience very mild symptoms. But that might be the booster shot, so to speak, that everyone needs to put this thing to bed, finally. I hope so.
I hope so as well. There is some evidence that that may happen, so let's hope for it. It is true that it seems to me like, you know, before the first couple of waves, I didn't know that many people who had COVID. I knew handfuls. Now it seems like everyone I know has COVID. So it seems like it's really spread to a new level.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I think sort of the same thing happened, though, with the Spanish flu. Where it I mean, it was the same kind of a pattern, and it was like 3 years, right? So we're on the third year now, and I don't know, I hope so. I really do.
Anyway, it's a pleasure to be back with you, and I wish all your listeners a Happy New Year as well. I hope everyone's trying to stay safe and hanging in there.
Well, thank you for that. All right, so last time you were on, we talked about your book. We covered your book called American Schism. How's the book doing?
The book is doing very well. It's really terrific. It's become a bestseller. It seems to have legs. In other words, it's been on the Amazon bestseller list for many, many weeks. And it's getting more wonderful reviews. So, you know, overall, I'm very happy. I've been speaking a lot about it mostly with on podcasts such as this, but also on radio shows. I've been doing a lot of radio lately. And I'm very pleased. So overall, great.
Well, super. Well, glad to hear it. So before we got on, we were talking about some things that we wanted to cover in this podcast. And why don't we start with the headlines? You had mentioned that you were doing some blogging and that you were kind of year in review for last year, 2021.
Well, yes.
So,
yes. I think,
yeah,
I
go
think
ahead.
We can definitely focus on that a bit. I think that 2021 was such a difficult year in so many aspects. And I do think some of the headlines from the year are going to be very significant going forward. I mean, one of the ones that I think a lot about right now is the year-ago anniversary of January 6th. When what's happened is that over the course of the months of last year, more and more evidence has come out, really pointing to the fact that this was a coordinated attempt to overthrow power, to stop the peaceful transition of power. And to me, that's so important because one of our symbols in the world as an open liberal society has been the example of a peaceful transition of power. And I think this was the closest we came to an overthrow of that since the Civil War. Now, in the my book, I discuss some examples of other attacks on the government by citizens and what they were like, such as the Whiskey Rebellion and Shays Rebellion. And I think there are some parallels that are worth drawing, even though those particular rebellions were quite different.
Well, okay. I'll play devil's advocate on this one.
Good.
The one that I was going to mention was the Boston Tea Party, because I'm from Boston, so I'm kind of familiar with that one. And this was how our country was founded, was through revolution. I mean, essentially, the Patriots were no different, really, than the ones who attacked the Capitol on January 6th.
I don't think that's right. So let me push back. I mean, you're absolutely right that the American Revolution and the Patriots that were part of it was a rebellion against the crown, the English ruling party.
Yeah.
No question about that. And there were aspects that were protest and violent. The Boston Tea Party did get a little bit hairy, as did, by the way, the events after the Stamp Act. That also created a lot of rioting. But here's what it was. We had in July 4th, 1776, the leaders of the colonies came up with a rational argument, which, by the way, became the Declaration of Independence, that put out evidence of why rebellion was necessary, why forming a new government made sense, based on a very complete set of grievances. And the grievances were very specific. There was a long list of grievances, including things like, you know, taxation without representation, etc. So my point being that, yes, the country was founded on a rebellion, but the rebellion was ultimately led by leaders who had a very strong case, a rational argument with a lot of evidence that was backed up by specific examples and a framework for why this made sense. Now, the reason why I mention the Whiskey and the Shays Rebellion was because it's very interesting. Shays Rebellion, which was not even before the Constitution was ratified, was Daniel Shays was a hero who fought in the American Revolution and was wounded. And, you know, one of the parts of the system to pay for the war that really was developed by the Federalists, by Alexander Hamilton and the Federalists, was a taxation scheme that was going to hurt many of the farmers. And Shays was a farmer in Western Massachusetts, and he was furious. So he and his buddies and crowd rebelled and tried to overthrow the government of Massachusetts. Now, so in Washington, how George Washington handled this event was very specific. He wrote significantly about how it was not the same as the American Revolution because it did not meet the criteria for rebellion, an overthrow of the government, as the Revolution did. And in fact, he listened to the rebels and ultimately not only heard their call, but to some degree changed. There were modifications in the policy, but ultimately needed to use force to put down the attempted overthrow of the government. And around that time, all of our founding fathers, the framers, because that was during the time when the Constitution was being framed, they wrote at length about the difference between a rebellion and a protest versus a true revolution. And the point being, and this is why I take issue with your argument, the bar was quite high. And I don't think that the January 6th protesters had any basis for factual, empirical evidence relating to their grievances. It was mostly a mob that was wound up by the big lie and months and months of propaganda, as opposed, in fact, to evidence.
Well, okay, your point is taken. However, I'm not sure I'm convinced that this was the closest thing we've had to an overthrow since the Civil War. Because if, in fact, it was just a protest gone bad, Was there any real serious threat that these people were going to actually overthrow the government? I mean, this was the image that was portrayed. But
no, I think Douglas, I think it's part of three. There were three concentric rings. So in other words, the mob that hit the Capitol was one part, but there was a very in-depth legal strategy that included trying to get the certain electors disqualified so that it would be a contingent election in the House. And I'm not sure if your listeners are aware, but a contingent election in the House would have been a win for Trump. And that's what they were trying. So there was actually a coordinated strategy that was being led by many of Trump's henchmen. And there were also then a second ring, which was the support in Congress. There was a handful, more than a handful. There were a couple of dozen of representatives in the House and some senators that were part of this plan, which is coming out. So I think you're going to see that it wasn't just, you know, when you say, could these people really have overtaken the government? The attack, the violent attack on the Capitol was one part of an overall plan.
Oh, all right. So it just never got any further than that? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And not only did it not get further, but when you look at what happened, it was very close in the following sense. It all boiled down to the way Pence was going to interpret the 12th Amendment regarding the Electoral College. And, you know, the question was whether he was in fact going to disqualify certain electors from certain states. And that would have thrown the election back to what's called a contingent election, where every state votes for a candidate. And there were 27 states that had Republican delegations. So it's not proportional like the House itself is. It's based on state by state. 27 states were Republican and the rest were Democrat. The only question was really Wyoming, which was Republican, and whether Liz Cheney would have in fact would have gone against the popular vote, so to speak. So she might not have, but there were still 26 House states representative contingencies that would have voted for Trump. So we were actually very close. This, you know, I've read a lot about this, and I'm not only talking about the legal memo that's been leaked that came from Trump's lawyers, and some of the material that was, you know, sent back and forth via text by Sean Hannity. I'm talking about the actual details of what the people in Congress were debating and what their plans were, which has been more and more documented. So I think, you know, it's interesting. I have a lot of people in my circles like you who they're not arguing as many Trump supporters are that it wasn't violent. But they are saying it wasn't that meaningful an insurrection. It was a rebellion gone bad, to use your terms. But I think more and more is coming out that it was really part of an overall plan. And in 20, 30, 40 years, I think it's going to be remembered as the most significant disruption of our peaceful transition of power since the Civil War. That's my view. I may be wrong, but I think a lot is coming out that your listeners should take a look at.
Well, I'm just not seeing it just yet, but although I haven't done as much research as you have, so we'll see, you know.
We'll see.
The interesting thing, I had David Baldacci on a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. You know who he is?
Oh, sure. I love David. Great author.
Famous writer, yeah. And I asked him this question, just hypothetically, what do you think a civil war would look like in the United States today? What do you think it would be?
Well, there's no question that there is such a division and there's been such a focus on what tears us apart as opposed to what holds us together in the last 5 or 6 years that I think it's possible. The tricky part is that it's not geographically favorable. In other words, the real issue is between cities and rural areas. That's where the fault line kind of falls. And because it's not geographically contingent like it was in the slave states of the Confederacy and the border states, I think it'd be hard to actually, what would it actually look like? That's where it gets very confusing. I don't think it's reasonable that rural areas in America secede from the Union. I think that's not what you're having. Instead, I think is, and this is why I get so worked up about it, if you will, what you're having is a rejection of democracy. The whole notion of the way our democracy works, one person, one vote, that's being undermined by a set of trends. One of which, of course, which is, by the way, one of the other important stories of the year of 2021, is that 22 states, individual states, have enacted comprehensive new voting laws, which governors signed under the auspices of election security. And it turns out that what were those 22? So 22 states, it's a lot of states. What are those new voting regulations? What are they about? I've looked at some of them in detail. And I think there's certainly a case can be made that some of the measures in those regulations can, in fact, make elections secure. But when you take into account the data, the empirical data, as well as the history in the country of using voting regulations as a tool to suppress voting, I think the picture becomes much more bleak. In other words, I think that these 22 laws, for the most part, are going to make it harder for certain people to vote. And so this is, in my view, a veiled attempt at voter suppression. And now, again, I've not read all 22, but I've read some of them. And when you look at the data, there has been some fraud in elections, but it's never been systematic. It's been a couple of votes here and there, never enough to overturn an election. So what these measures are correcting for is frankly elusive, because there hasn't been documented fraud. The question is, you know, are there controls related to paper ballots and mail-in ballots and all that? And it's been shown that there are. And so look, some of these elements in these voting laws in these 22 state regulations, some of them may in fact ensure that paper ballots are secure and have controls, okay. But a lot of them also, I think, will make it difficult for certain constituents to vote.
Well, that's interesting. So this federal Voting Rights Act that's being debated now would supersede all of these 22 states that they enacted?
So, right. Well, no, the intent was, so the original intent of there were two bills, the John Lewis bill and the Voting Rights Act bill, which if they had been passed as Democrats wanted, they would have superseded, yes, many of these regulations, or at least made invalid certain parts of these new frameworks. Now, what's happened is there's not support for that in a bipartisan way. And so it looks like what might happen is there might be a bill that's a weaker version, a toned-down version, that Sinema and Manchin will sign on to, because they need, of course, they need to do two things. They need to make sure it's not covered by the filibuster, in which case they would need 60 votes. So the first question is, can they have a Voting Rights Act that just requires a majority? In other words, can it be exempt from the filibuster rules? And then the second question is, will they have enough votes, which they need 50 votes, and Sinema and Manchin have not expressed support for it? So what I think might happen is a watered-down version of the bill might end up getting passed. There's two ways that could happen. One is by succeeding at exempting this from the filibuster and having Manchin and Sinema join, and then they would have 50 votes in the Senate. The other is there's some talk of a more bipartisan. Manchin is trying to get like some Republicans on board who are less, let's call it, Trumpian than others. People like Mitt Romney and a senator from Maine, Susan Collins, etc. So there might actually be a more bipartisan approach that some Republicans would sign on to. That's the other way this could get passed. But my point is, the question of will it be strong enough, will it have teeth, is really doubtful, given that it's not going to be the strong bill that initially was intended.
Well, you know, my concern with voting integrity, which I'm all for, I think that we do have to have secure elections, however we get to that point.
Yep.
But the one problem that I have, and this is adding to the division in this country, is basically you praise one group while condemning another group for the exact same actions. That is like the fastest way to divide a country.
And give me an example so I understand what you're saying.
Well, okay. In the year 2000, there was an issue with the election in Florida, with
right.
And the Democrats screamed that it was Al Gore's state and he should have won. And then the Supreme Court voted in favor of Bush, right?
Right, correct.
So we had a lot of people on the left side of the aisle claiming that the election was illegitimate and that Bush was an illegitimate president, blah, 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 blah. Okay. In 2016, the same thing happened when Trump won over Hillary, okay? Same thing. People talking about collusion, and then they had 3 years of Russia, Russia, which turned out to be nothing. Okay, now in 2020, the other side started doing the exact same thing. This is right. An illegitimate election. So what I'm concerned about is, number one, that every time we have an election and the people who lose are going to start screaming that the election was rigged, that it was fraud, it was illegitimate, which we can't have. Otherwise, right. We're going to have chaos every single election. And the other thing that I blame is the media for skewing the will of the people, or the cry of the people, if you will, to the left. Okay?
Yes.
And that's a problem. That's just adding to the division. You know, people have a right to their opinions, and they have a right to espouse them. But what happens these days is that, depending on your opinion, you'll either have the right to espouse it, or you'll get canceled.
Okay, I think the media definitely plays a role, and you're right. And I think that the media, and this is something also that I discuss in American Schism, the incentive system for the media thrives on this type of stuff. Because if the elections are controversial, people are going to tune into TV more, you know, and click on things, etc. So there's no question that the media is playing a role here. But I think there's a false equivalency in what you laid out, in my opinion. In other words, the Florida issue in 2000 was very specific because there was like five votes separating the two candidates. So there was there was actually real concern about what the answer was, who won. Now, the false equivalency is, I don't think what the Democrats did after 16, they recognized, well, Hillary Clinton won 3 million more votes, the Electoral College is how we elect presidents, and Trump won the Electoral College by a reasonable margin. So I don't think there was anybody saying the election was fraud or that it was false or corrupt. I think there was an issue later on about Trump, whether the Trump administration was getting help from a foreign adversary. We can disagree about whether, I mean, you're right, there was no clear evidence that that was the case. Do I think Russia interfered? Yeah, they did, so along with probably other countries. But there was no definitive proof that the Trump administration had asked for their help. So that's fair, but that was a specific issue. But that's not equivalent to what's happened to what we call now the big lie. This has been a campaign that's gone on for over a year now to continually drum into Americans that the election was fraudulent, and in fact included Trump and his cronies making calls to state regulators, to the attorney generals of many states, trying to convince them to quote unquote find more votes for Trump. So this is not an equivalent thing to what happened after 16. And I think it's important that your listeners understand that, because one of the things that's happened in the last year or so is the fact that if you look at the polls, I think it's 70% of Republicans today still believe that Trump won the election. That's extraordinary. So too few of the Republicans in Congress, Senate, and House have supported the reality. The rest of them have been allowing this lie to propagate. So to me, that's a big issue, and it's not the same as what happened in 16. And you're right. I mean, not only is it hurting our democracy, there's a question of whether we can ever have an election that people believe in again. It's very disruptive. In fact, that's one of my big fears. You know, people who know me, Douglas, know that I'm you know, I probably a center, maybe a bit center left, but for much of my years I was a Republican. I'm a very conservative, my personal beliefs are conservative, especially related to economic issues. But the fact is, so it's not that I'm like a diehard liberal who I'm trying to be concerned about what's going on here. I'm concerned because I'm an American who believes in our democratic form of government. I'm concerned like Liz Cheney is concerned. And that's my point, is that this coordinated attack and this big, the propagation of the big lie has been an extraordinarily destructive set of events regarding whether our democracy can have fair elections going forward.
Well, I think that's the sort of the ultimate point here, is mm-hmm. that regardless of who wins and who loses, we can't have the media, the right or the left, screaming that the election was illegitimate. That
right.
whatever the results are have to be accepted. Now,
yes.
having said that, we do have to make sure that our elections are secure so that we don't have Russian collusion, so that we don't have fraudulent mail-in ballots and from dead people and whatever else they were talking about. You know,
yes.
people voted three times. All of that's got to be cleaned up before anyone is going to accept the results of an election.
I think you're correct, but there were 62 cases brought alleging the things you just discussed. Dead people voting, 62 cases. None of them made it through even one round in the courts because there was no evidence. So I think they found in Georgia 11, when they did the count many times, they found 11 examples of a dead person that voted, 11 votes. I think in Arizona they counted the vote 22 times. So my point being that of course it has to be secure, but the insecurities are much more fabricated than reality. That's the point of this whole thing. And also I would ask you, do you know of, even in 2016, Hillary conceded the next day? This is the fact that Trump has himself not accepted the election is an extraordinary thing.
Well, I would agree with that, you know. And I think, just to give a comment specifically on Trump, I think that Trump's greatest strength turned out to be his greatest weakness. And when somebody makes the presidency all about them, even though some of the things he did I agreed with, some of his actions, not with the election, but just while he was in office, you know, you can't make it all about you. And I think that turned so many people off that might have been more supportive of his policies. It got to the point where people just didn't even want to hear him speak.
I could 100%. I mean, I think there was some, I think it's the way Sean Hannity described it in the text. The thing was to go home back to Florida and to regroup for 2024, not to contest the whole thing. I mean, so I think Republicans like Mitch McConnell have it right in terms of what should have happened. I would agree with you that it became all about him, but, and I also agree with you that he did some things that were good. One of the examples I like to use is, I think, the way he stood up to China was something that no previous president was willing to do, which was quite, whether we follow through on it or not is another question. But his point of view regarding the way China trades with us, the way they steal stuff, etc. So I think there were many things that he did that were good. But I think that the notion of making it all about him happened not only in the election. It started happening. It was clear to me, let me give an example. When he hijacked the COVID briefings to make them celebratory events about how good he was doing, that was very obvious, I think, to most people, that the purpose of those briefings originally were to help people understand what was going on with COVID, but instead it became a platform for him to address the American public. And most of what he was doing was vanting, bragging about how great they were doing. So that was an example where, why again, when people were dying, hundreds of thousands of people were dying, did this become about him? I think that's the example of that shows, in my view, the pathology of Trump. as an egotistical maniac. But that's another point of view. We don't have to discuss that. But you're right that I think it has irritated a lot of people, but I still think he could win. He still has a lot of support.
You think he can win in 2024?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, here's why. You have to remember, voting has become a way of expressing how angry and grievanced you are, right? So it's voting has, because the system has fallen apart, and as discussed this in the book, I believe our entire political system, the two-party system, is broken. So
I would agree with that. Yeah.
It's quite true and valid that voters should be frustrated. They should be. And what Trump is able to do is, even though he was the establishment, he has been able to really be the champion of those against the establishment. And his support base, let's say it's 30 to 40% of the country, it suffices for something to go wrong with the economy or continued problems with COVID for enough Americans to abandon, let's say, Biden runs again. So I think it's entirely conceivable that he win again. Absolutely.
Well, the other reason why I would tend to agree with you is because I don't see anybody viable on the Democrat Party.
Yeah, I think that's right.
I mean, I think, let's face it, I think Biden is just going to be too old.
Yes,
I think
you're right.
I don't think he's got the juice left, you know. I think he's done. Yep. Kamala, zero support. You know, she got 2% when she ran on her own.
Yeah.
That's not a good positive number. The other one they're throwing out is Pete Buttigieg. Yeah, I don't think so. You know?
Yeah.
I think if anything, and unfortunately, I think him being gay, openly gay, is gonna hurt him. I think people are not quite there yet to vote for an openly gay man for president of the United States. And I also think that he's just too young and too inexperienced. He's very articulate. He's very smart. But, you know, I don't think he's quite ready yet.
There's only one Democrat that I know of that could beat Trump if he were to run in 24 for sure. And that's Obama. And he won't do it.
He can't run, can he?
He can, because you can't have more than two sequential terms. So I think theoretically he could run, but I don't think he would.
What about Michelle? The people have been throwing that one out. Even Joe Rogan threw that one out.
No, I don't think that'll happen. No, I think your point is very valid. There's not a strong leading Democrat. So that's another reason why it's conceivable that Trump wins.
You know, the one thing that I noticed during the 2020 campaign was that whether you like Trump or not, he had unity on his side that the Democrats did not.
Yeah.
The Democrat Party seems to be very fractured between the Joe Manchin moderates, which are a lot of the American people, the blue collars, the unions who always supported Democrat.
Right.
And then the far radical side, the AOC squad, those people, the woke crowd, if you will.
Yep.
And there's so much infighting. But with Trump supporters, they were unified.
Yep. They line up.
I mean, you see those rallies he had and people standing in minus 20 degrees and waiting there for hours and hours just to see him. They weren't doing that for Biden.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, I think that's right. I think those are the Democrats have a lot of problem in terms of uniting their constituents. There are huge splits. It's a very wide tent, but it tends to fragment and fracture. I think what I hope for is that we really modify the whole election system, which probably will not happen soon. One way of doing that is to get rid of the two-party system by having multiple more parties and having ranked choice voting, more candidates. Now, that's something that I think is actually being implemented in some states at local level. So I think there are various experiments at the local level that are conducive to reforming our democracy. But at the national level, it's probably pretty far away.
Well, I would agree with you on that. I think we need to get away from just the two-party system. I don't think it's serving the will of the people. I think it's been hijacked, for lack of a better word.
Absolutely. I concur. It's been hijacked, and if you look at where elected officials, especially at the national level, spend their time and money, it's much more about getting reelected than about problem solving.
I mean, to use an analogy, I don't know if this is quite accurate, but spirituality in the pure sense of the word is probably the best thing that any man, if he can find it, can experience in his life. And organized religion came along and hijacked the concept of spirituality and yes. turned it political and turned it violent against people who were non-believers of their specific doctrines. I mean, we can go through history from the time of King Herod, right?
Yes.
And just go right through. Okay, which I don't want to get into. That's a whole nother show. The point being is that democracy in its purest form is a wonderful thing, okay? However, I think democracy, to a point, does have to be regulated. See, spirituality, I don't believe, needs to be regulated, which religion has done to it, organized religion. Democracy in its purest form is like spirituality in that sense. It's every man is on an equal plane. We are free. We can think what we like. We can do what we like. However, we have seen the results of runaway capitalism in 1929.
Yep.
So obviously there needed to be FDR to come in and put regulations on this stuff. And I think our democracy does have to have rules. We have to have laws because people will abuse the system. You know, freedom is something that can be easily abused. So you had mentioned erosion of democracy. I guess it brings up the question then, is the democracy that we have in America at this current level, this current state, is this really ideal? Or is there some new form of democracy that we haven't figured out yet?
I think it's the latter. And I'm not sure that we haven't figured it out. We've abandoned it. And let me give you a few examples. There was, again, this is discussed at length in American Schism. First of all, by the way, your analogy to religion, I love. I think it's very, that hijacked analogy is very powerful. And I think our democracy has been hijacked. And here's what I mean. In, I think it was 2016 or so, I forget which election, when the Republicans took back the Senate, Mitch McConnell was quoted as saying at a press conference, "Elections have consequences. Winners make policy, losers go home." And that is precisely the wrong way to think about democracy. In other words, democracy is a system that is supposed to be epistemologically superior, where we learn from each other. And what winning an election means in a democracy is that you get to chair the conversation. But the first thing you have to do as the winner, quote unquote, is invite the loser back into the conversation and
right.
forge compromise.
Yes.
So in other words, the way democracy works, and this goes back to our Constitution, it was one big set of compromises. It's all about compromising for the greater good, even when there are aspects of the compromise that you don't like. So when I say our democracy has been hijacked by people who will not compromise and believe in some purity, ideological purity that views compromise as a dirty word. And we can't have a democracy that way that's functional. You know, I quote in American Schism, the work that has been done by various groups that show that the vast majority, 70% of Americans, make up a segment of what I refer to as the frustrated majority, meaning that it's really the extremes, the 30% extremes on both sides that believe it's more important to not compromise and stick to your beliefs than to compromise. Whereas the 70% and the frustrated majority believe that compromise is necessary. And they believe also, another interesting part about those segments in the middle is that they believe we have more in common as Americans than that which tears us apart. So of course, it seems like the conversation is completely dominated by both sides, both left and right. And that goes back to your point before about media. I think the media makes those extremes, it amplifies those extremes for profit. So the fact is, if 70% of the Americans are frustrated, a frustrated majority, and understand that we need a more productive discussion, that's what I hope, that's my hope for the country. That in fact, this 70% will realize that the extremes in both parties, both sides, are, it's like the lunatics are running the asylum, and we'll throw the bums out and get more problem solvers who are rational and willing to compromise in positions of leadership. And I think that has to happen for us to rescue our democracy.
Well, I totally agree with you. I can't even play devil's advocate on that one because I'm completely in agreement. Absolutely. Yeah. Let's shift this just slightly to the role of America on the world stage. But before we get to that, because I know you had mentioned Afghanistan and we have saber rattling going on in the Ukraine and with China and Taiwan. Okay, lots going on. Before we get to that, though, I want to throw this idea out at you and see what you say. The idea of identifying as an American is something that is unclear to me. And the reason why is because we have broken ourselves up into all little subgroups. Teddy Roosevelt talked about hyphenated Americanism over 100 years ago, and he said it was dangerous, and he didn't agree with it. He said people can come from wherever they come from. We all came from somewhere else, okay? Even the Native Americans came over from Asia 5,000-6,000 years ago. So everybody came to this land from somewhere else. However, once we got here and once we established this as the United States of America, people became Americans. And when people immigrated, particularly in the early 1900s, a lot of them changed their names to anglicized names, which I'm not saying people need to do, but I'm just saying people were so gung-ho on becoming an American. They learned to speak English. They may have kept some of their own culture in their home, but when they went out, they wanted to be as American as the people that got there before them, which is always the way, right? You always model yourself after the people who got there first. Okay, so now there is this push for all of this kind of racial identity, cultural identity, religious identity, sexual identity, gender identity, the identities go on and on and on. And I think it's detrimental to this idea of a united America, because now everybody is going to identify with whatever they feel that this is what makes them an American. And it really doesn't. I'll give you an example. Do you know who Steve Harvey is? He's a host of Family Feud.
Yes.
Okay. He's been doing the show from South Africa. He's got the South Africa edition. And I don't know if you've seen that, but it's on YouTube. And so Steve Harvey is black, right? And he went to South Africa. He's doing the show. He has the families who compete against each other. On one particular episode, I made an observation. He had a black South African family versus a white South African family. Okay. He was the odd man out, even though he was doing all of this, hey, bro, to the black family. They weren't buying it.
Right.
To them, he was just an American. Okay.
Right.
The black and the white South African family had far more unity and affinity for each other because of the culture, not because of their skin color.
That's great. Okay. That's a very interesting thing.
So when I saw that, it sort of brought to my focus that whole concept of hyphenated Americanism and what Teddy Roosevelt spoke about. That if a white American had suddenly walked into that studio, he would be right in with Steve Harvey.
Yeah.
And the white and the black South African families were in tune with each other. They spoke the same language. They understood the culture. All of these sort of cultural cliches and things, they all knew what they were talking about. Steve Harvey hadn't a clue what they were talking about.
Well, I think your point is very valid. I think a lot of this new identity politics is very dangerous for many reasons. There's no question that to have a cultural identity, it's fundamentally based on what some people call a hierarchy of values. What do we value as a society? What's our value and our experience? And I think we can't ignore that. We have to continue to build and evolve our values and our experience. I think it starts with the Declaration of Independence is where our values start. And I think it's what it's evolved to be really goes back to your point before about what is our role in the world. America became a beacon of hope across the world, not for our military force, not for situations like Afghanistan. We became a beacon of hope for two things, in my view. One was that despite all of our flaws, we were the best example of self-government that ever existed on the planet.
Yeah.
Number one. And number two, we were a place where, irrespective of how you were born, whether you were noble or not, you could make it, be successful here. Mm-hmm. Anyone could make it with hard work, sweat, and tears. And so that, and again, that's this model for all its imperfections, are the American model of meritocracy. Those two things are why we became such a symbol, a powerful beacon of hope. And I would argue those two things are fundamental in what I referred to before as this hierarchy of values. Now, for most of the 20th century, we held those things up against enemies. And it's always easier to unify a culture when you have an enemy. So in the 20th century, the enemies were first fascism and then communism. And as a consequence, we as Americans were drawn together to fight that enemy. What you're raising is very valid. Is first of all, what do we have an evolving hierarchy of values that we can speak to and that Americans identify with? And do we have shared experiences that are meaningful, like the families that did on the show in South Africa? Or is that crowded out by these individual, let's call them sub-identities? Even though we're American, we have all these, whether it's religious or sexual orientation, we have these sub-identities. And our American identity that's shared is getting crowded out by these sub-identities. And we have to reverse that. Now, how do we do it? Well, there's many practical ways that we could do it. I mean, I'm not saying we need to get another common enemy, although a common enemy is often helpful.
Oh, it would be very helpful. If the Martians invaded tomorrow, we'd all be united.
Right, correct. Yeah. But I think shared experiences, like let me throw an idea out. One of the things I advocate in my blog about American Schism is that we should reinstitute a year, a compulsory year of national service in the country, so that all Americans, when they're 17 or 18 or 19, spend a year visiting some other parts of the country and doing some other kinds of work, meeting other Americans on their turf. See that's the way to build. You know, for many years, the armed forces, I mean, years, decades ago, was a place where all Americans served. That's not so much the case anymore. It's kind of been divided by class. And I'm not saying this national service need be military. I'm saying it's some experience that where you understand and meet different Americans. And so those are that's what builds common bonds and common hierarchies of values, if you will. And I think we've let that go in the name of our sub-identities. And that's a recipe for disaster.
I agree with you. And I agree with you about the National Service. I was thinking the Peace Corps, because I think for some of these hardcore identity politics people, I don't think meeting another American is going to do it. I think they need to get out of the country and look at it from the outside looking in. Because once you go out of this country, and I've spent, I don't know if I told you, I spent 3 years in Thailand teaching English back in 2007. And not in Bangkok even, out in the rural 300 miles north.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, that was a learning experience for me. When I came home, my political views had completely shifted.
Yeah.
In just those 3 years. So my point is that some of these people need to be taken out of the United States and sent, like the Peace Corps, to Africa or to Southeast Asia or the Middle East or somewhere that is just completely different and let them stay there for a year. And I can almost promise you that they will come home with a completely new sense of what it is to be an American.
Right. I think that's a really good idea. But I think that there is a way to do this that's by visiting other parts of the country. But I like the international part as well. I think you're right. You know, one of the problems with social media, for all the benefits of the digital age, is when you're communicating anonymously or without seeing someone in person, the whole civilized way we treat other people tends to get thrown out the window. It reminds me of a story with my son, who's 15, and I've noticed that, you know, because so much of his interaction with his friends is through texting or through games or whatever, that an important coming-of-age experience for a teenager is when they're in school, which now they're kind of all masked, so this is going to make my point even more relevant, is to see when they say something nasty to a kid in the playground, they see the reaction of the other kid that it hurts him or her. That you can see the physical reaction, right, or the facial reaction of saying something hurtful has a huge effect on how people civilize themselves. Because we recognize that words can hurt. But in a digital environment, when you message something nasty, or none of that physical interaction is experienced, and I think something is lost there.
I agree, and I think that the internet generally provides this sort of anonymity shield for people, that they wouldn't dare say things in person to somebody in their face that they'll say on a message board or on Twitter or something like that.
Exactly. And, yeah. And you know, I sometimes do a thought experiment. I imagine that we had a Facebook or a Twitter or whatever where every account was authenticated so that you couldn't just be some random person. You had to actually, like you know how you have to get a driver's license You had to get a license so your account could be tracked. All of a sudden, those people who are so critical and shouting and screaming and throwing eggs, I don't know how much they would do that. If they had to be responsible for their tweets, yeah, so to speak. So it's that kind of thing where I think it's very detrimental. And you know, I further argue, by the way, that what's happened is we all have these primitive drives that relate to attacking an out-group and being part of an in-group. We all know it because we feel great when we're in a sports stadium rooting for our team. But now we're treating each other like that in public, where, you know, we're treating everything like it's a sports arena, to sling mud. And for the public discourse, that is not a good mindset. You need to listen much more. It's not about rooting. It's about listening.
I agree with you. And Seth, on that note, we're going to have to wrap up this interview. Would you like to come back for part two? Because I think we got a lot more to cover.
I love discussing this stuff with you. I think it's really helpful. And by the way, I think this is part of the solution, is like shows like yours. Like if you want to discuss an issue like immigration or whatever, you got to be able to get into it a little bit as opposed to tweeting slogans at each other. So I appreciate agree. Being able to be here.
Well, thanks again. Give out your website for your book, please.
It's AmericanSchismBook.com. So AmericanSchism, S-C-H-I-S-M, book.com.
Okay, great. And we will continue this interview on part two, date to be determined. Thanks, Seth, so much for coming.
Thanks so much.